Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day through our free email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or straight from the tap at the website supchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today I'm in Washington, D.C., just a stone's throw from the White House. Joining me from his home in Goldcorn Holler in Nashville, Tennessee, is a man still smiting from losing the male lead in Crazy Rich Asians to that, despite a stellar audition, I think it's fair to say, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, why did they give it to Henry Golding instead of Jeremy Goldcorn?
Oh, that's really, you're reaching the bottom of your ability to stretch this joke, Kaiser. I think it may have something to do with my face for radio. And also, I'm not usually considered Asian, which I thought was kind of the whole point of the film, but...
So. Oh, 你名字叫金玉米，你怎么不是亚洲人？
是。 All right. Now, enough of the lighthearted stuff.
Yeah, way more serious now. So, I mean, there is no issue today that demands the attention of anyone who cares about human rights in China more than the mass detention of Uyghurs in the Xinjiang Autonomous Region. For over a year now, we've been reading reports about what have been termed re-education centers, and now hundreds of thousands, and by some estimates as many as a million, mostly Uyghur and Kazakh men, who are thought to exhibit characteristics of Islamic extremism, have been taken to these camps with no legal recourse. Apparently, these supposed characteristics of extremism can include just growing a longer beard or demonstrating basic Islamic piety, maintaining a strict halal diet, abstaining from alcohol, that sort of thing. Even if half of what is being reported, even if a tenth of what is being reported is true, then it's an atrocity, and it reminds me nothing so much as the internment of people of Japanese descent in the United States after Pearl Harbor.
I mean, as a kind of a Jew, my first thought when I hear about massive camps and, you know, numbers up in the millions obviously goes back to Nazi Germany. Before we start making such comparisons, though, let's just set the scene. We have seen some excellent reporting from mega Roger Gopalan, who was until recently, when Beijing refused to extend her visa, the BuzzFeed reporter and bureau chief based there. We hope to have her on the show soon. But her articles are, of course, worth reading, as is the coverage from the Associated Press's Jerry Shi, who spoke to us earlier this year about Xinjiang. There's been great reporting from Josh Chin and others at the Wall Street Journal. And we've seen an extensive report on the camps from the scholar Adrian Zenz at the European School of Culture and Theology in Korntal, Germany, who published in the Jamestown Foundation's China Brief. In the last few months, there has also been an increasing amount of attention being paid to the issue. It has been raised with Beijing by a United Nations panel, and it is now to the point that Chinese officials have felt compelled to break what had either been silence or brusque denial and acknowledge at least that there have been detentions in Xinjiang.
We're going to continue to bring guests onto the program to talk about this important issue, but today's show isn't going to be specifically about the detentions. Rather, we're going to talk about the Uyghur community in diaspora and its efforts to raise awareness and bring pressure on Beijing over its treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And joining us to talk about these groups is Nuri Turkel, co-founder and chairman of the Uyghur Human Rights Project, former secretary general and president of the Uyghur American Association, and former legal advisor of the World Uyghur Congress. Nuri was born in Kashgar during the Cultural Revolution and has been a very vocal, very tireless advocate for the rights of Uyghur people. He works as an attorney here in Washington. Nuri, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you, Kaiser and Jeremy, for having me on your show. I really appreciate this opportunity.
We're delighted to have you.
Nuri, let's start by talking about your own story, including the remarkable circumstances of your birth. And then perhaps you could also tell us about how your attitudes towards the Chinese state when you were a boy growing up were formed, and the relations between the Han and the Uyghurs in Kashgar prior to 1997, when, as far as I know, things started to deteriorate sharply.
I was born in captivity at the height of a Cultural Revolution, where my 20-year-old mother was taken in when she was 6 months pregnant with me, mainly because of her father's past political life, being a member of the East Turkestan Republic in 1944 through 49. The Chinese government viewed that my mother's family herself as some sort of political family. So she was taken in. At the same time, my father was sent to labor camp, which is 4 or 5 hours away from Kashgar.
Like a Laogai kind of
Laogai
thing.
Yes. And my mom was in Laojiao. My father was a Laogai. So after she was taken in, she was subject to various forms of physical and verbal abuses. Someone who was born and raised in a very conservative Uyghur family could not bear that abuse, particularly name-calling and insulting the baby in her body that she's carrying. And as she was injured during that time, she broke her ankle and sitting bone, and she was put in cast. 3 months later, she delivered me in cast. And we were released about 5 months later. I was having very serious health issues because of calcium deficiency and lack of exposure to natural light. And I was very weird-looking kid with a huge head. Even at some point, my grandfather told my mom, please don't let your son being seen. Otherwise, people will be very judgmental and it will hurt your feeling.
So, just for the record, he looks very normal and very handsome now, I must say.
Thank you. People thought that I would never survive.
Okay.
So after we released, my dad was still in Laojiao, labor camp, and he lost his job. He's one of the first generation graduates from the Xinjiang University. Mm. He's originally from the northern part of the country called Gulja. He was sent to Kashgar for improving education in the Kashgar education system. And yet he was not only expelled, but also sent to a labor camp, mainly because of him having two cousins in the Soviet Union, and also his affiliation with my mother's family. And then after he was released, my mom was the main breadwinner. She was able to return to work and supported my dad and myself. And then in 1978, my dad's employment was restored. So basically, he was jobless for 8 years.
Right.
And then my brother was born. And because of this family history, because of this torturous experience my young mother had, because of her family background and political belief, I was raised to love the Uyghur people. I was raised to appreciate the Uyghur culture. I was reminded of my parents' bitter history simply because of who they married and what kind of relatives did they have. During my education years in Kashgar and Urumqi and Xi'an, I always maintained very strong Uyghur identity. I was educational Uyghur educational system through high school, and then I went to study in China with the Chinese students. So I grew up speaking both Chinese and Uyghur, and I thought that learning the language is very helpful in order to be able to not only survive but thrive in Chinese society.
Right, right, right. And what were your attitudes by the time you were in, say, university toward the party state? And how did they shift as you went through college and went abroad?
This was, I went to university in late 80s and early 90s. Mm. This was a political transformation period in China.
It sure was.
Yeah, this was right after the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy movement and opening of China. So the Chinese government was relatively flexible in their minority policies. I was one of those handpicked Uyghur students to study in inland Chinese university. It is unthinkable today, but then at least the university professors and students on campus treated us very well. Actually, some in some instances, they treated like foreigners.
That's good to hear. I mean, not that, you know, you should have been treated differently at all, but that they were treating you well. It makes me suggest that maybe there is still a reserve somewhere in the Chinese population of empathy or even sympathy for minority nationalities.
The reason being, Kaiser, if I may, the government was not as aggressive as today to portray right. the Uyghurs as some sort of threat to the society, ungrateful minority, or, you know, extremist or separatist or terrorist for that matter. Then they portrayed us as some sort of happy minority.
Right.
The Chinese students were curious. You know, they liked to make friends with us, you know, joining us in some Uyghur parties even, you know, so stuff like that. It was very casual, like normal relationship I thought that we had when I was a college student in inland China.
And this was in Xi'an at Xi'an Jiaotong? Or?
No, this was a university on the suburb of Xi'an called Northwestern Agricultural University.
Oh,
now
okay,
changed
okay.
it to Northwestern ANF University.
Ah, I see. And were there a number of Uyghur students there?
There were about 30 in my class, so about 120 students altogether, give and take.
Things really started to change, though. You said, you know, this period of flexibility in minority policy, it really, at least toward the Uyghurs, it started to change very much in 1997. Is that correct? Am I correct in identifying that as a major inflection point?
I actually sensed the change after the collapse of the Soviet Union in my senior years in college. So we start seeing independent Turkic states on the other side of Uyghurs' homeland, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. And then in the mid-90s, the Chinese government get paranoid that they didn't want to have the Soviet-style collapse. And seeing the Uyghurs demanding political freedom like the their siblings on the other side of the border. So they started what's called a Yenda.
The strike hard
campaign. Right. And this also has something to do with the Barin uprising that took place in an area close to Kashgar.
Can you give us the rough... I'm not familiar with that uprising.
There was an uprising led by some religious figures demanding initially a religious freedom, and then it turned into a violent clash with the Chinese military.
And what year was that, Nuri?
In 1990s.
Okay.
In early 1990s.
Early 90s, I see. And then, you know, other inflection points, though. I mean, so in 97, we're familiar with a lot of the problems that happened then. September 11th, though, and the whole global war on terror, another inflection point, maybe?
That 9/11 has changed the political landscape dramatically.
Mm.
As we recall, by doing a simple research or by doing a simple... You can find out by doing a simple research that a few weeks before 9/11, a Chinese government held a press conference claiming that Xinjiang is a safe place for investment and there's no violence. And then weeks after 9/11, that position changed dramatically, and the Chinese government officially claimed that China also a victim of terrorism.
Right.
So 9/11, as has been reported by various NGOs and government entities and media organizations, have given the Chinese government a golden opportunity to tap into people's fear and try to be part of the U.S.-led global war on terrorism that I have an issue with. I mean, that particular terminology in itself is somewhat problematic.
We'll talk more about that. And then, of course, 2009... in Urumqi, and then, of course, in other parts of Xinjiang as well. That was another major inflection point that we'll get into a little bit more. But do these points sort of match up with inflection points in your own development as an activist?
Yes. I initially thought that that Uyghurs always mistreated, discriminated against, you know, socially, politically. But I never thought that it will reach to the level that we are seeing today. Have had very deep impact in my personal and professional life. I must add that the ethnic tension, the political repression has already been there, but it had gotten worse over time, as starting mid-90s in 2001, 2009, 2016, and now what we're seeing is probably the darkest period in Uyghur history.
A lot of this is rooted really kind of in basic Han Chinese chauvinism and racist attitudes toward Uyghurs, who I think a lot of people who've lived in China are familiar with. They've seen sort of the stereotypes that many Chinese in cities have toward Uyghurs. Could you talk about what those are and your own personal experience maybe of some of that kind of stereotyping?
I think it has a lot to do with how the government portrays the Uyghurs. If you know, in China, there's no political freedom for the most part. When you live in a society that we rely on Chinese government propaganda, then you have a tendency of believing. And oftentimes I noticed and have sensed that the Chinese people always mixed up criticizing the government versus criticizing the Chinese people.
Yes.
Two different things. So when the Chinese government criticize something that is in the interest of the Han Chinese people, they applaud. But if they being criticized, including the people of China, they immediately turn on and become it takes a racist position. I like to believe that the Chinese people are making a terrible mistake by not paying attention to this issue, because eventually what the Uyghurs are going through will be expanded to the other regions in China. I see that the Chinese government using Uyghurs' homeland and Uyghur people as a laboratory to create a total surveillance state, which eventually will be Orwellian society on steroids.
Nuri, the situation in for Uyghurs has been grim for some time, but now, as you say, it has reached this extraordinary point, both in terms of, you know, what is happening, but also the scale, the number of people that are involved now. And at this critical time, you seem to be emerging as the leading voice among Uyghurs in the West for your cause. Is that true? And how do you feel about this role? Is this something that you actively sought?
I've involved in the Uyghur advocacy work in both personal and official capacity since 2002. At a very young age, I got elected as the president of the Uyghur American Association, and also co-founded the UHRP, which is basically a research and documentation arm of the Uyghur advocacy work that has been produced a tremendous amount of public reports in the last 14 years. And also, on my personal level, I believe that as a free person, it's my moral obligation to speak out. I think this. I cannot think of a better way to utilize my freedom, my education, my experience, to tell the truth. You just need to be brave enough and tell the truth. This is how I feel about this work that I do proudly in advocating Uyghur rights. Uyghur people are voiceless, and we need more people in the free world to speak out on their behalf. Because, you know, if you don't speak out, the silence is almost as bad as committing any type of atrocities. So I feel honored and obligated to be a voice for millions of Uyghur people back home.
As you said, that requires quite a bit of bravery, and I think we're all in great admiration of that bravery. It comes at significant personal cost, too. I know that your brother actually married a daughter of the well-known Uyghur activist Rabia Qadir, so I guess she's your brother's mother-in-law. When they got married, bad things happened to your family as a result of that marriage, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, as we discussed, my mother and I have a very special bond because of the way that she brought me to this world. As I recall in my childhood years, my mother always said, you know, I pray to God to allow me to live long enough to see you getting married, and I want to hold your children. So with that desire, my mother was prevented from attending not only my wedding in October 2007 in Turkey, and also my brother's wedding in Washington in July 2007, same year, simply because my brother was marrying one of China's most hated Uyghurs' daughter. And also I was involved in Uyghur human rights activities, advocacy work. So by guilt by association, Chinese government effectively punished and caused a mental anguish, preventing my parents to attend two of their children's wedding. That could be one of the most important days in my life, in my brother's life.
Very sorry to hear that.
Nuri, can you talk about your parents now? What is the situation now?
My parents are going through a very difficult time, both emotionally and health-wise. My dad suffers early stage of dementia. He's 79, a retired university professor. And my mother is a former state employee. She's only 67, but she's been suffering a severe form of anxiety disorder. Mm. I have not seen my mother since my law school graduation in 2004. My parents were prevented leaving the country despite very high-level involvement, a request by senior U.S. government officials, both at the White House, the state, and also in the Congress. This effort started about 9 years ago when Obama was a president, and we made no progress. The last thing I know was in November 2017, during President Trump's visit to China. My parents' name were given to the Chinese as one of the concerned Chinese citizens for the United States government. Because of this internet or communication blackout, I am not in the position to find out their mental state, well-being, other than just to hearing their voice occasionally. My dad and mom, they have been going in and out of the hospital quite frequently lately. Mm. And, you know, it makes you feel powerless and weak and somewhat guilty for not being able to give them the necessary support when they were lonely in the hospital. I might add, they have four children. None of them are Chinese citizens. And we're not in the position to be there when they needed us the most. And
also, are you able to travel to China? Is that out of the question?
I have not been traveled to China since my last departure exactly 23 years ago.
You've applied for a visa?
No, I did not. Okay. I did not try because I didn't want to subject myself to harassments or even unthinkable things if I were happened to be on Chinese soil.
And what about harassment here in the United States? Have you experienced anything by way of pressure from the embassy here? I mean, you live here in D.C. Have you had any kind of, to your knowledge, any kind of harassment or troubles that originate from Beijing?
There's no direct harassment, but the indirect threats have been made. But they have used their informants or people collaborate with the Chinese to damage my public image, professional standing in different occasions. But there has not been a direct threat against me by the Chinese government.
Touch wood.
Nuri, let's talk about the Uyghur Human Rights Project, as well as some of the other organizations in the Uyghur diaspora. What are the main active groups right now? What are the goals of the different groups? And are there differences between these goals?
There are three major organizations that you see in public today. The first one, the largest one, is the World Uyghur Congress. World Uyghur Congress is based in Munich, Germany. Current president is Dolkun Asa, a former student leader in 1988 student movement in Urumqi, a year before the one in Beijing. And the former president is Rabia Kadri. She's currently a special leader for the organization. World Uyghur Congress is founded in 2004 in Munich. Since 2006, it receives a grant from the National Endowment for Democracy for democratic leadership training projects that they undertake twice a year in various countries, bringing in young Uyghur activists and leaders and train them to be more effective advocates. And World Uyghur Congress is the most well-known organization and also have been the main target for Chinese attacks. The Chinese government has done it in different ways. One, by putting current president on the Interpol list, preventing him from travel around the world. He was actually detained a couple of times in different places, Italy, North Korea, even here in Washington at the airport. The U.S. government issued him 10 years of visa. And this is the gentleman who lost his mother in a concentration camp a few months ago. And also, the Chinese government also uses its diplomatic and economic influence to prevent World Uyghur Congress to engage in political activities, namely Turkey. The World Uyghur Congress leadership has not been able to travel to Turkey except for a couple of them. Ms. Kadir cannot travel, Dolkun Asa cannot travel, one other gentleman who is also one of the senior leaders in the organization cannot go to Turkey. And then Chinese government, as you have been reading on the paper, been very active discrediting, trashing the World Group Congress at the UN forums. Thanks to European Union, Germany, and the world, the United States government, the UN presence and involvement for the World Group Congress have been preserved. And the Uyghur American Association, the second largest or well-known organization based in Washington, D.C.
Which you were a co-founder.
I served as Secretary General and the President from 2002 through 2006. Mm-hmm. Uyghur American Association was founded by Uyghur intellectuals in 1998.
Nice.
It's been good 20 years since its founding. It is a community organization, a political organization at organizes various events for the community, the protests, and reaching out to members of Congress, that sort of, you know, typical immigrant community activities. But Uyghur Human Rights Project that I co-founded in 2004 undertakes research and documentation projects, programmatic and the issue specific, which is also funded by the NED. So in summary, there are three organizations. All of them have very good relationship with various governments, including our own government here in the United States. All of the three organizations aim to work to achieve the Uyghurs in China or East Turkestan to achieve their right to self-determination through peaceful and democratic means. So any of the claims that the Chinese government have been making against the World Uyghur Congress or its leadership does not have any evidentiary backing. They are peaceful. All three organizations are very peaceful. They have been engaging various governments. That's why they were able to establish credibility and visibility and recognition, most importantly.
You're very upfront about the fact that your organizations are funded by the NED, which is, of course, the boogeyman for China. China hears these letters, NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, and goes crazy. Anything that is touched by the NED is necessarily, you know, dedicated to the violent overthrow of, or the nonviolent overthrow of Chinese authoritarian the government. Has this been a double-edged sword for you? Does this prevent you in some way from gaining sympathy from Chinese who might otherwise be interested in the Uyghur cause?
That is an interesting question. Yes, I have read and heard statements and reports linking NED to some dark side of the U.S. government. And U.S. government is picking up some organization through NED to, you know, destabilize China or tarnish Chinese government's image in public arena. But it does not hold any water. So we're very pleased, you know, as a taxpayer, I'm very pleased that my tax dollars are going to some legitimate cause and legitimate organizations. Without NED support, Kaiser, I must say, we were not able to come to a point to be recognized as a legitimate voice for the Uyghur people. The UHRP produced and World Uyghur Congress produced reports, issue-specific reports, have been cited not only by various media organizations, but also State Department's annual human rights reports. Mm-hmm. That speaks volume. It's kind of a collaborated effort. If the World Uyghur Congress or the UHRP did not have the type of legitimate professional work products, then no one would be listening. So this couldn't be done without any of these support. So I'm personally very grateful.
Let's change topics very quickly here. You've done quite a bit of work on the Guantanamo Uyghurs. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with who they are and, you know, what ended up happening to them, how they ended up in Guantanamo, could you give us an overview of this?
This Guantanamo work that I was able to be part of was one of the best things that ever happened to me professionally. Mm. I could not think of a better way to utilize my educational, legal skills, cultural background, language skills, other than my involvement. Back in 2004-2005, Center for Constitutional Rights managed to get hold of some names through FOIA request. And those names showed some Uyghur names, allegedly from China. And the same organization recruited some lawyers to represent them in a habeas petition. That's how I got to know will get involved in the project.
These were fighters who had been captured on the battlefields in Afghanistan.
Right. Really. That's what the Chinese government alleges, and also that's what was the thinking in the Bush administration's detention of them and bringing them to Guantanamo. They initially, you know, there's various different stories about their background. Some told us directly or through interrogation that they were in Central Asian countries because of the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They could not stay, so they end up being in this lawless land that didn't require visa or passport, which is Afghanistan. And some of them tell us that they were in some Uyghur village. Nonetheless, they were not captured in the battlefield. They were sold to the U.S. military by Pakistani bounty hunters. $5,000 per person. There are only few of them were arrested or captured in the northern part of Afghanistan, but the vast majority of them were picked up by bounty hunters. So initially, the U.S. government thinking was they may have some intelligence value. It turned out not to be the case. And they transferred them to Guantanamo and tried to find a home for them, thinking that if any of those guys were able to find a home somewhere, it will prime the pump and open up some doors for others who are no longer enemy combatant. That's the term that the government used. So the Uyghur case, this 22 guys case, went all the way to the Supreme Court, started in the district court in Washington during the Bush administration years, and then Obama's first year, because people like Eric Holder, Greg Craig, and Ambassador Fried, very adamant about reselling the Uyghurs, initially in Virginia. But one of our traditional allies, Frank Wolf, introduced a legislation called the Keep the Terrorists Out of America Act that kind of killed the process, and then they end up being in Bermuda.
Frank Wolf, senator from Virginia, he was...
Congressman
from Virginia.
Yeah,
right. And he was ordinarily, like you said, very, very... Well, he was quite anti-China.
At the same time, very sympathetic to the Uyghur human rights work.
Yeah, you weren't able to persuade him that this was...
Impossible. Not only us, some of his congressional colleagues were unable to persuade him. So with that deal not going through or falling to the cracks, the Obama administration were able to resettle four guys in Bermuda. Just a couple of days ago, they were granted citizenship, which is a good news. So all of them are gone. And most of them are in Turkey and some parts of Europe. So they're starting to restart their lives. You know, I'd like to highlight something very important. Despite how they are labeled by the Chinese government, despite how they were perceived by the United States government, since they being released as early as 2005, none of them have done anything silly, if not stupid. They've been trying to reestablish their lives, get married, starting business. If you go to Tirana, Albania, you'll probably find a couple of Uyghur restaurants run by former Guantanamo detainees. Same is true in Istanbul.
I probably won't be going to Tirana, Albania, but thanks. I mean, it's good to know that there's good Uyghur food there.
Uri, you mentioned earlier the connection between the so-called global war on terror and what's happening in Xinjiang today. I'd like to talk a little bit about anti-Islamicism, Islamophobia in the West and in the United States, and how it's used as cover by Beijing for its aggressive moves in Xinjiang. And if you could also maybe talk about what you know about rising Islamophobia in China itself, and if you see this as being a factor in what's going on in Xinjiang right now.
I see two problems, Jeremy. One is the Uyghurs happen to be wrong type of Muslim, and then China appeared to be the wrong type of adversary for any Muslim countries or Muslim people to even show sympathy publicly. It is mind-boggling that to this day, since the current nightmare started about 18 months ago, no Muslim countries, no Muslim leader came out even criticize the Chinese government the slightest. Traditionally, Turkish government has been very, very vocal, to the extent aggressive. Back in 2009, as you know, that the Turkey is not a country that you can casually use the word genocide. The Turkish prime minister then,
because of Armenia in 1915.
Yeah, because of their own history. The Erdogan, President Erdogan, then Prime Minister, said publicly that there's no other way to see it other than likening it to genocide in public in response to July 5 unrest in Urumqi. And the Chinese government saw this as some sort of threat, because in Turkey, the Uyghur situation is very, very unique. The Turkish kids growing up, learning about the Uyghurs as their ancestors. In order to change the Turkish mindset, you have to change their textbooks. It's impossible. Pre-Ottoman history is pretty much the Uyghur history in Turkey. So because of this enormous public support, enormous sympathy, the Chinese government is very concerned. So what they did is try to work with Erdogan administration, which was also trying to find a friends after the problems starting in 2014 and their inability to join the EU and deteriorating relationship with the United States. So Erdogan find an ally in Putin and Xi Jinping. So because of this strange bedfellow-like relationship, the Chinese government were able to convince Erdogan and his government to agree on an extradition treaty, which is very rare, and also made the Turkish foreign minister to say in public that Turkish government will not allow any anti-China activities or propaganda on their soil. So that is the beginning of silence in the Turkish government's end. So the reason that the Muslim world is not speaking is partly because of Erdogan. If Erdogan claimed to be the leader of a Muslim world, a voice for Muslim people,
especially for Turkic people.
Yeah, he has spoken about the Sudanese. He has spoken out about the Rohingya Muslims. And yet when it comes to the Uyghurs, he's dead silent. So, you know, the other Muslim countries need to look at either Erdogan or Western allies to find their voice. That has not happened. And in China, because of Chinese government's portrayal of Islam as some sort of mental disease, in a similar way that they did with the Falun Gong in much less degree, some good Chinese people in my mind believe in Chinese government's rhetoric that Islam is a bad thing and it might be a threat to their society. So I can relate lack of or no interest in the Uyghur suffering among the fair-minded Chinese and also growing Islamophobia among a general public in China. It's somewhat related.
I often look at news stories that are written about Xinjiang and about China's crackdown on so-called Islamic extremism and separatism and radical Islamism. And often I see right-wingers underneath Americans who, because of their own Islamophobia, say, "Oh, good. This is what China. This is what countries should do. They should, you know, ban Islam." I have this sense that growing Islamophobia here in Trump's United States, and you know, encouraged, abetted by the president himself with his, you know, travel bans and all this, is undermining support, certainly from the administration, but even more broadly in the American public for the Uyghur cause. Is that your sense?
I can relate the two. Actually, I have written about this on China File. If you know, timing is everything in politics. With Trump coming to power, Xi Jinping making himself president for life, and this anti-Muslim rhetoric and sliding from democratic principles and walking away from the leadership in the world, I think in a way encouraged the Chinese government. It does not. I would not claim that it will go hand in hand, but this shining city on a hill is losing that stature. So, what moral ground would you have to criticize someone else when you were doing something very similar, if not the same? So, I think with the current administration's initial approach, some of the rhetoric plotted by President Trump's supporters with respect to Islam is not really helping the United States diplomatic engagement. One example, Kaiser, you will like this. Not too long ago, Secretary Pompeo called on a ministerial international religious freedom. There are about 60 countries in attendance. Mm-hmm. Only United States, UK, Canada, and Kosovo signed a joint declaration. condemning Chinese treatment of Chinese Christians, Uyghur Muslims, and Tibetan Muslims. That is very telling. If the United States cannot get a 10 out of 60 participants in such a big international conference, then it's a problem.
It's a sign of something.
It's a problem. It is a serious problem. And also the Chinese government is taking this as an opportunity. And, you know, if you don't have a moral authority, you are not in the position to ask anyone to do anything better than you could not.
Right. Nuri, I've often gotten the sense that, and I think most people probably agree, that there's a lot more popular sympathy here in the West for Tibet than there is for Xinjiang. I think this was certainly the case even before all the rhetoric on the war on terror and on this, you know, anti-Islamic sentiment had been stirred up by the sitting president. Jim Millward actually once related a remark that he attributes to a Uyghur activist. I don't think it was you, maybe it was, but he said, "The Tibetans are pandas, they're cute and they're cuddly, while the Uyghurs are camels." Is this still the case, do you think, or has this been changing now?
I think that has changed. In the past, we admired the Tibetans when they were getting so much publicity. In politics, some bad publicity can be turned into your advantage. You know, no crisis should be wasted. This is a common terminology that we hear. I think the current political environment in China has given an opportunity for the Uyghurs' voice to be heard. I know it's a horrible situation. It's a horrifying situation. It's a mind-boggling situation. At the same time, with all this hoopla or bad publicity that the Uyghurs gain in the international political environment, since 9/11, since the war in Syria, it was very difficult for Uyghurs to advance their cause. Because whenever you go, the response is like, okay, there's some violent incidents in Kunming or Beijing or Urumqi. How do you explain? And the Chinese government has a legitimate reason. And now how can you justify locking up that many people in a no-right zone? So this in of itself has given an opportunity for the Uyghur activists, Uyghur organizations, and we are seeing some effect of that effort. So, you know, this is a critical movement in the Uyghur history. This is a terrible crisis, humanitarian crisis, as been portrayed by some of the U.S. Lawmakers. But at the same time, I think this put the Uyghur issue on the international map.
Right.
You can tell by just flipping through the Google News every day, right and left, commentators from the right, from the left, everybody is writing about it. So this is, in a way, better publicity for the Uyghurs. Because here's why. The Uyghur issue has been likened to some dark chapters in the human history.
Right.
Stalin's gulag, South African apartheid, Hitler's concentration camps, America's Japanese internment camps, everybody, even Jim Crow. Everybody's talking about some ugly chapters, comparing it to some ugly chapters in human history, which is a good thing in my mind. How do you get people's attention? Again, this has to be translated into new real action. The politicians are not showing a political will because of this entrapment in the Chinese economic influence. But in a public arena, I think Uyghurs have gained enormous traction and sympathy just by looking at the public statements being made. And one other example, Kaiser, you know how much effective the Chinese government has been self-censoring you American scholars.
Sure.
I never thought that the American scholars specialize in the Uyghur issues would issue a joint letter sympathizing with the Uyghur situation. That is a very telling example how the landscape has changed. And right. Some of the most effective messages have been put out by American experts.
And there have been two now. There's the Darren Byler letter, and then there's...
And then the Jim Millward. For example, Jim Millward says something that people never said. He said specifically in one of his public speeches, whatever the Chinese government claim, paraphrasing, of course, whatever that they try to justify cannot be related to Chinese government's security concern. It's not about fighting against terrorism anymore. This is powerful. This has been quoted And he has already related Uyghur issues to ordinary people's life by laying out all the surveillance apparatus the Chinese set up. Ryan Thum, one of the young historians in the American academic world,
sure, I know him.
Have been writing and have been saying, actually he did a fantastic piece in Foreign Policy magazine.
Yeah,
so there's an awakening. And now I think the Tibetans probably feel like we should get that kind of publicity as well.
Can I ask, Nuri, you've described a difference in the approach that Tibet activists and Uyghur activists have taken, if I'm not mistaken, that the Tibetan activists tend to take a more grassroots approach, whereas the Uyghurs, it's more kind of top-down organization. If that is a correct characterization of what you've said, could you explain the strategy and why you've adapted it and how it may change now that your cause has the limelight?
We initially thought, this is an excellent question. People always said, oh, Uyghurs don't have Dalai Lama. That's why people don't know the Uyghurs. It's not true. The Uyghur issue is by design, taken a top-down approach simply because 9/11.
Right.
So when the Chinese talk about Uyghurs as a whole as being a threat or a terrorist, you have to counter that claim. So in order to do that, you have to deal with the elites in the society, the media, academia, politicians. Even as we discussed earlier, the Uyghur case has been discussed widely in the United States federal courts all the way to the Supreme Court. So when the legal scholars, influential public opinion leaders, members of Congress, even presidents start telling, even jokingly about the Uyghur stories, that will get attention in among American elites. Obama was making jokes about the Uyghurs in Palau. A lot of people feel offended, but
where some of the Uyghurs had actually been temporarily
settled in Palau.
Right.
So top-down approach was by design and strategic way of advocating the Uyghur rights. Because, you know, let's face it, it's very difficult. In the post 9/11 world, how would you get public sympathy for a Muslim people?
Right.
Who is under the control of this economic giant that has intimate economic and trade relationship with the United States and elsewhere. So it's impossible. So you have to reach out to the elites. I think it has been working out very well.
Yeah, I think that approach makes a lot of sense to me. It seems to me that there are many more Uyghurs outside of China these days who are suddenly willing to talk to the press about what's happening to their fellow Uyghurs in China, even willing to be quoted by name and talk about their family in Xinjiang. What do you think is behind this? Is this something that the UHRP has been pushing? Have you been pushing people to engage with the media more?
This has been a multifaceted approach on an individual level and organizational level to encourage people to be brave. Again, being so
the enormity of the current atrocity.
Yeah, and then also people starting to realize, Kaiser, what worse could it be? What do they got to lose?
Right. What more can they do to us?
Yeah, and the Chinese government has been so effective. They've been not only harassing with denying passport renewal application of their own citizens living overseas, they're affecting the citizens of Europe and North America, Australia. You know, it has only worked so far, but more people are coming out and testifying actually on Facebook almost every day. Real stories, pictures of those loved ones being detained in concentration camps. It's been powerful. When I've seen quite a few already in the last 2 weeks.
UHRP is documenting all of this.
UHRP, right? And the World Uyghur Congress is documenting.
Great.
And this will be eventually a report. And when this will be eventually evidence for governments, media organizations, or NGOs requesting for evidence.
Nuri, can I ask you about the East Turkestan Islamic Movement or Turkestan Islamic Party? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in the past, organizations that you've been associated with have denied or at least strongly questioned the existence of these organizations, which the Chinese government calls terrorist organizations. Is that still the case? And how does the fact that some Uyghurs we seem to have confirmation have joined Islamist groups in Waziristan or in Syria. Does that affect the work of the World Uyghur Congress or the UHRP?
I have to make this very clear that I personally believe that there were such organizations exist. Not at the scale that some of the security companies, some of the organization tracking terrorist activities around the world to portray some sort of, you know, organization with the org chart, chain of command. Exaggeration has been out there. There have been, their existence and influence have been largely exaggerated. And also one other factor that helped with that kind of false image or perception is back in the early period of Bush administration, in order to get at least Chinese acquiescence for invading Iraq, the Bush administration and Chinese government managed to, or agreed upon, two things. One, designate East Turkestan Islamic Movement, ETIM, as a terrorist organization, which expired in my understanding. It was designated for a certain period of time. And then, two, allow the Chinese interrogators to come to Guantanamo to interrogate Uyghur detainees.
Did that happen?
Yes, it happened.
Hmm.
So the back then, the argument was by U.S. Congress, you allow the Chinese interrogators to come to Guantanamo and you don't even allow us to go to talk to them. So there was some irony there. So those organizations, both ETIM or TIP, I believe were a real organization, but their existence, their power, influence, and affiliation, most importantly, are exaggerated or been propagated without any evidentiary support.
Thanks. That's actually a very, very good statement of your position. Now, maybe a more difficult question about your attitude toward Rubia Kadir, who's a very controversial figure. On the one hand, she may still be the best-known leader in the Uyghur diaspora, probably is. I think a lot of us were dismayed, though, and felt she had really undermined the cause when she was, for instance, traveling to Japan and decided to visit the Yasukuni Shrine, where many Class A war criminals are interred. What did your organization say about that, and how do you personally feel about her?
I think she's a tremendous individual. As you know, as your listeners may know, that she was actually promoted by the Chinese government initially as a model citizen.
Yeah, and she's also very wealthy from she, business in China. Right?
She was believed to be one of the top wealthiest people in China before she got arrested in the late 90s. And also she served on a rubber stamp National People's Congress as a representative for the Uyghur people. That's her background. The Uyghur people revere her because of her willingness to speak out by using her influence in the Chinese society and her philanthropist work, humanitarian work. But after she was detained and released into the United States, you know, all politicians make mistakes. I think that going to the shrine is one of her mistakes that she personally acknowledged. And let's don't forget that she is not fluent in any foreign language. And also, I know that it cannot be an excuse, but I think that some Japanese folks
manipulated her.
I you know, it happens anywhere. When you don't know the background of the people that you're dealing with, you can be vulnerable. So you have to be vigilant about the people that you associate with.
I think that happens to foreign dissidents in Washington, D.C., who get co-opted by think tanks of various political persuasions who may not actually have their best interests at heart.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Chen Guangcheng.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you know, Chen Guangcheng, Wei Jinsheng, Rabia Kadir all have made a similar type of, political missteps. But, you know, she has not lost her stature in the Uyghur movement. She still is the face of the Uyghur suffering.
Okay.
Her 20-some family members serving in, have been detained. Her two sons individually served prison time before the current saga started. So she is currently the leader of the special leader of the World Uyghur Congress. Still a very powerful voice. But she has yielded the presidency to a younger generation last November, which is very admirable.
Nuri, I think that's a good point to ask you how you have navigated the politics here in the United States. It strikes me that much of the support you've gotten has come from political conservatives like Marco Rubio and Chris Smith, as well as other old school Cold Warrior types or their new incarnations, the anti-Castro folks, more generically, you know, anti-Reds. It seems like you've gotten less traction with Democrats who used to be more ardent champions of human rights. How do you diagnose this situation and how are you responding to it?
From my own political advocacy work, I realized that American people are generally very interested in oppressed people's stories. I think it's an American gene and DNA. Especially, and I find it quite helpful, actually, talking to people who have experienced similar suffering in the U.S. Congress. And also what I find one of the things most helpful is to publish editorials. I personally have written a few. And also navigating Congress is, I find it to be the most important thing in, especially in the current toxic political environment. Because the administration side always either timid or very cautious or show a unwilling to show a political will because of the ongoing engagement with China. But in the Congress, it's a little different. The congressional offices have been very helpful in reaching out, in a way requesting the administration to take certain steps. There's nothing tangible as the way that have the Tibetans were successfully able to do in the U.S. Congress, such as Tibetan Policy Act. But the resolutions, congressional hearings, the letters. In fact, today, 17 members of Congress from both sides of the political spectrum wrote to Secretaries Pompeo and Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, to request them to implement Magnitsky Act.
So Global Magnitsky Act.
United States Congress could actually do more. One of the things that they could do is appropriate some funds through annual defense bill to help with the Uyghur people to understand what violence means. So this is actually in the United States government interest to fight against this ideology. And ironically, the United States Congress or the administration have been a leader in the Uyghur struggle, despite a public perception in the Muslim world that, you know, this government is in crusade against Islam, whereas the others who have a direct interest in the Muslim people's lives have not spoken out. So I applaud the United States Congress for whatever reason that they are being active and vocal. But on the Democratic side, my personal thinking is that they may have been silent because of the business interests in their districts. For example, CECC has two California members or commissioners, but they have not spoken out. As you guys know, the Chinese government has been very skillful in lobbying the United States government. They don't go to the administration oftentimes, or go to Congress. They go to the business leaders. And then the business leaders come and pressure the members of Congress. Actually, this has been said by Marco Rubio publicly and Christmas publicly. So I suspect that some of the Democratic members of the United States Congress have been somewhat quiet. Nancy Pelosi, for example, a known advocate for human rights in China, said nothing.
Interesting. Interesting theory. Nuri, when I've argued about Xinjiang, as I often do with my Han Chinese friends in Beijing or even here in the United States, I've found it's possible to gain ground when I keep my arguments within certain bounds, like not openly advocating for independence. When I make the case, for instance, that Uyghurs as legal citizens of the PRC should be entitled to the same rights, however limited those rights might be, that any Han Chinese person would enjoy in this notionally multi-ethnic state, and that they suffer significant discrimination, for example, not being allowed to take airplanes or to stay in hotels. And this is well documented that there's been, you know, significant discrimination against them. I think I can get some empathy or at least some sympathy you know, that there's this shared experience of a repression. Isn't this an approach that you might want to take to try to gain the sympathies of Han Chinese people with that shared experience and hope that you might affect some sort of change from within China? I mean, I know it's a very imperfect analogy, but I think about the United States in the civil rights movement. And I think the cause was greatly helped by the sympathies of Northern whites who got on buses and rode to the South. What, if anything, are you doing to try to reach more Han Chinese?
Two thoughts. One, UHRP has already begun this work. We have a Chinese outreach program. We have a Chinese blog regularly published on the UHRP website. Our target is the Chinese audience who might be sympathetic to the cause. Mm. And then two, I think the fair-minded Chinese people start paying attention to a symbolic statements being made by President Lincoln. As long as we have slavery, we'll not be a free country. I think the Chinese people need to develop something along the lines of, we cannot be a powerful country as long as we mistreat our own citizens.
Right. We have to be judged by how we treat our most vulnerable people, right?
That kind of exactly. thing. Exactly. Right. I'm paraphrasing, and the concept is, as you pointed out. And also, Chinese people have to be very, very vigilant. Xi Jinping is testing the waters. Our Uyghurs today could be there tomorrow. It makes me really, really worried.
You mean the sort of techno-authoritarian Orwellian surveillance state technologies?
Yes.
The DNA and all that stuff.
You know, I worry that one of these days, the Chinese citizens, Han Chinese citizens, will be subject to the similar type of surveillance and prevented from going to places because of their political affiliation, political thoughts, past writing, travel history, whom they're married to, whom they're associated with. I think this whole thing happening to the Uyghurs should be a wake-up call. And also the Chinese people should start paying attention to their heart, not the propaganda by the Chinese government.
Well said. Very well said. Nuri Tsirkhel, we want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this vitally important issue. And we look forward to following up with you in the future on this. But before we pack up here, let's do our recommendation segment. First, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's premium access service and enjoy extra content, including additional newsletters and stories and early ad-free access to this podcast. Seneca is the flagship podcast in an expanding network of podcasts that now includes the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, and the New Voices podcast. So we're very excited to be adding more shows this month, so keep watching this space. On recommendations, Jeremy, why don't you kick us off? What do you have for us this week?
I have a series of books, well, two books, graphic novels, and they're sort of relevant to the content of today's show. You may know them, Maus by Art Spiegelman. The story essentially of a Jewish family in Hitler's Germany told in
M-A-U-S,
the form of...
M-A-U-S, right, Maus.
M-A-U-S, as in German spelling of Maus. And basically the Jews are mice and the Nazis are cats. And it's a rather extraordinary way of reading about a terrible time of history because, you know, you're looking at something that looks a little bit like a children's book, but it's telling you about these very, very terrible things. And terrible things that, unfortunately, I've been thinking of a lot recently as we've been working on the events in Xinjiang.
Thanks, Jeremy. That's great. Nuri, what do you have for us?
I have a report and three books to recommend to your audience. The first one is a UHRP report recently released. The title of that report is The Mass Internment of Uyghurs. We Want to Be Respected as Humans. Is This Too Much to Ask? And you can get access to this report in a PDF format at uhrp.org. And then I'd like to recommend three books in light of our today's conversation. The first one is by Professor Ryan Thum, The Sacred Roads of Uyghur History.
Right.
And then the second one is this book what tells the Uyghurs' history or Uyghur biography in a historic context. This is very relevant in light of the fact that Global Times just published report claiming that the Uyghurs have nothing to do with the Turkic ancestry or Turkic culture. So this book
that was the most laughable thing the Global Times has ever reported, and they've published a number of laughable things.
And they made the Uyghur Uyghur politician, the mayor of Urumqi, saying that collaborated by a couple of Uyghur Chinese officials. So this book is an excellent reference for learning about the Uyghur historic biography.
Yeah.
And then the second book I'd like to recommend to learn about the Uyghurs' transition in different period as far as their social, political, economic life is an excellent book by Professor Gardner Bowden of Indiana University, The Uyghurs, Strangers in Their Own Land. And then finally, our good friend Jim Millward wrote a book about Eurasia that explains Uyghurs' relationship to people in Eurasia continent.
Eurasian Crossroads, right?
Yes, excellent book about history of Xinjiang. So those three books would be very helpful for your audience to know on a historic and societal and political aspect. But the current situation that the UHRP report would be excellent, in addition to the one that you published in SubChina.
Yeah, did you? What did you think of that?
It's an excellent. My hat's off to your researchers who came up with such a comprehensive, fact-based, logical analysis and summary.
I will pass on your compliment to Lucas, who was chiefly responsible for
Please
that.
Please do. It has been widely circulated on social media.
Great. I'm really glad to hear that. And my recommendation is a little more frivolous, but it's the album Harry Belafonte Live at Carnegie Hall. Harry Belafonte, was an ardent champion of civil rights in the United States. My mother had a huge crush on him when I was a child, and we always listened to this record. It was recorded in 1959. I just actually got a copy of it in an old used record shop in Fargo, North Dakota, on vinyl. It's pristine. It's absolutely perfect copy. It's so much fun. I was at a sort of sing-along party at my friend's house in Madison, Wisconsin, and there was another guy there who knew this album, and we started busting out all these crazy old songs from Harry Belafonte, and to the delight of everyone there. Harry Belafonte Live at Carnegie Hall. It's just a great record. He's a beautiful voice. The song selection is amazing. For fun for all ages. Anyway, Nuri, thank you once again. It was just what a pleasure it was and an honor to meet you. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me on your show again. Thank you, Jeremy. I appreciate
the questions.
Nuri. Jeremy, great talking to you as always, man.
Likewise.
The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn and edited by me. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Sightseeing Cynica Business Brief, the Pandaily Tech Buzz China, and New Voices. More shows coming soon. Watch the space. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.